So in essence, we're looking at the occupation of units of property known as hereditaments, and it's the beneficial occupation of that, which is the value of that occupation to the occupier. So people often describe it as business rates, but that is a complete misnomer. It's the taxation of non-domestic property, primarily through its occupation, but in modern times also through unoccupied property of hereditaments shown in the rating list. Two other things I just want to mention in this introductory observation is the history is actually really quite important and quite significant. So the modern act that we're going to talk about, the 1988 Act, is a pretty threadbare statutory scheme. And quite often when you're coming into this subject, it's worth looking back at the case law from previous times and trying to understand how that relates to the modern statutory scheme. And a number of cases have emphasized the importance of that history. The key tip I would have is that it's often useful to understand the history, but then also to always think about whether it's different under the modern statutory scheme, which is the 1988 Local Government Finance Act that we'll say a bit more about in just a moment. The other point is rating is an important funding stream for local governments. It's one of the most important sources of local authority revenue, and that makes a really big practical difference. Now, that was traditionally the case up to 1990. For a short period between 1990 and 2012, the direct financial interest of local authorities in rates disappeared because effectively they were collecting it, handing it over to central government, who by a very complicated formula were then handing it back to local authorities. But there was no direct correlation between local authority funding and rates raised. That's changed again since 2012 with something called rates retention. So local authorities are now particularly interested in what the rating position is, and they've got now again a direct financial interest in the collection and enforcement of rates, which makes a practical difference to its operation. So that's the 2-minute summary of what rating is, and we're now going to go on, and I can introduce my colleague Luke, who's going to pick up and start introducing some of the key terms, section 2, the language of rating, terms that you need to know. Luke.
Thanks very much, Dan. Good afternoon, everyone. If you're new to rating and you were to read a textbook or a case or a website or something, you'd be forgiven for thinking you'd stumbled into an entirely foreign language in some respects. There are so many terms in rating which have a specific meaning. And we thought it'd be helpful to take you through about 10 or 11 of the key terms and give you a sense about what they mean. I'm going to start with probably the most important, which is the notion of the hereditament, something Dan's already mentioned. In a nutshell, the hereditament is the unit of property that you're valuing for rating purposes. That has got so much content in it that we're going to have a whole session tomorrow where it's one of the two things that's going to be talked about. But in essence, the unit of assessment for rating purposes, the hereditament, is going to comprise the sort of property that you'd ordinarily associate with land law. So buildings, bare land, structures, and so on. It's not limited to those things, though. You can also have a hereditament which is made up of certain types of plant and machinery. And in some very rare and niche cases, a right can be a hereditament as well. But for most purposes, we're concerned with land and property. Now, it's quite common to hear the land or property which is valued for rating purposes described as being rateable. We talk about a rateable building or a rateable piece of land. That's not strictly correct. As Dan's explained, rating is really a tax on occupation, not on property. And the thing which is rateable is the person that pays the tax. And that brings us to the next two key concepts, because there are two ways that a person can become rateable. The first is if the person is the occupier of land. Now, you'd think, since rating's been a tax on occupation for getting on 500 years, we would know by now who was or who wasn't an occupier with some clarity. But regrettably, you may think, we haven't got there, and there's still a huge amount of dispute and difficulty about what makes an occupier. This is the second thing we're going to be talking to you about tomorrow, so I don't want to preempt too much of that session. In essence, if you're in a property, making use of it for beneficial purposes connected with your business, and you're there for a sufficiently long period of time, then you're probably an occupier. It's worth bearing in mind, though, that occupation is not the same thing as possession in the property law sense. You can be the possessor of land, but not the occupier. And vice versa, you can be the occupier without being the possessor. Even a squatter can occupy for rating purposes. Similarly, use and occupation are distinct concepts in this area. A person can use land and not occupy it for rating purposes. A person can, in some instances, be the rateable occupier, even if they make no use of the land. So it's a peculiar concept. And as I say, we're going to get into that properly tomorrow. If there is no occupier of a hereditament, then the person rateable ordinarily is the owner of that land. Now, owner in this context is a purely legal notion. The owner of a property is the person entitled to possession of it in the property law sense. So if you've got a landlord and tenant, it's going to be the tenant. If you don't have a landlord and tenant at all, it'll be the freeholder and so on. If you've got a trust arrangement, it's the trustee, not the beneficiary. But it's worth stressing at this point that whereas an occupier is almost always rateable, an owner is not always rateable. There are a whole series of circumstances where an owner is not caught by business rates anyway. We'll be going through that on Monday's session when we talk about exemptions and reliefs. I'm going to pass you back to Dan now, who's going to talk about some of the key valuation concepts. Dan, do you want to tell us what RV is?
Thank you, Luke. So RV is an abbreviation for rateable value, and every hereditament that's shown in the rating list has ascribed to it a rateable value. Now, it's important for everyone to understand that the rateable value is not the amount of rates that are paid. And Luke's going to come on to explain why that's so in a few moments. But the rateable value is effectively a notional rent calculated according to a statutory formula. And that statutory formula, again, we're going to mention this in a bit more detail in this session, and there's going to be a discrete session about it. But it's often known as the rating hypothesis. It's found in Schedule 6 of the Local Government Finance Act of 1988. And effectively, it's the rent to be agreed between a hypothetical landlord and a hypothetical tenant for a tenancy for year to year with a reasonable prospect of continuance in accordance with a series of statutory assumptions that are contained in there, such as that it's in reasonable repair. And the whole purpose of the rateable value is it's a notional rent that's determined taking account of the nature of the property, a whole series of statutory assumptions, in order to achieve what's known as uniformity of tax. So that like property is taxed alike. And we're going to talk a bit more about that on the valuation session, but that's what the rateable value is. Now, I've mentioned a number of times the rating list, and it's really important to understand what the rating list is. And in fact, there's a number of different types of rating lists. So one distinction you need to know is the difference between a local rating list and a central rating list. Now, central rating list is sort of the exception. There's a number of types of property that are valued en bloc, as it's said in the statutory scheme, like railways. There, the whole infrastructure of that is aggregated and done together. Another example would be the BT Telecoms hereditament. So those are in the central list. Everything else is in the local list. And so there's a local list, and local lists exist for a certain amount of time. So for example, starting in 1990, every 5 years, there was a local rating list for each area. So there's a 1990 local list, a 1995 local list, 2000, 2005, 2010, and then actually 2010 went on for 7 years rather than five to 2017. And then 2017 is currently, we're not quite sure how long it's going on. It's either going to be 4 or 5 years. But the point is, the local rating list exists. It contains all of the hereditaments. So you always need to ask yourself, which rating list am I dealing with? And is it an open list? In other words, a list that is capable of change by making proposals to alter it, or has it closed and this dispute is actually the last chance to deal with something? And there's complicated rules about that that are very significant. You need to know, is this, can this be changed? Can it be changed retrospectively? What can be influenced? Will this be the last change that could ever be made? And the detail of that is of very important significance. And those are the rules for making proposals to alter the rating list that we're going to come on to in due course. The next term I just want to deal with is a valuation term, the antecedent valuation date, or AVD, as people often refer to it. And this is the time in which the economic conditions for valuing in accordance with the statutory hypothesis are set. And this tends to be an earlier period. So for example, the 2015 rating list, the antecedent valuation date is the 1st of April 2013. So that's the relevant date on which the economic conditions are determined. And that's the purpose of the antecedent valuation date. The material date is the date at which the physical conditions, what the hereditament seemed like, what the nature of the locality was in physical terms, are determined. Now, at the start of the rating list, that will be the first date of the rating list. So the 1st of April 2010 for the 2010 rating list, the 1st of April 2015 for the 2015 rating list. But then certain proposals during the course of a rating list, for example, if there's a material change of circumstance, will have a different material date, and that's the date at which you make your inquiry as to the physical conditions. So it's quite often in the case in rating valuation that you've got this odd piece of mental gymnastics or valuation adjustment that you are valuing according to economic conditions on one date and physical conditions at another date. And you always have to adapt the evidence to apply it to those statutory assumptions. So that's the antecedent valuation date and the material date. Antecedent is economic and material is physical. Over to you, Luke, to talk about proposals and other things.
Thanks very much, Dan. I hope no one's head's spinning too much at the notion of having to value a property economically at one date, physically at a completely different date, with both dates being potentially over a decade ago now, as the 2010 list is still very much open for business in the courts. Dan's mentioned the concept of the proposal, and the proposal is an absolutely critical function that you have if you're acting for a ratepayer and that ratepayer wants to challenge the contents of a rating list. The proposal is the formal document. These days it's generated online, but it used to be able to be done on paper or on a form, which sets out exactly what it is that you think is wrong with the rating list, the respect in which you say it's inaccurate, and how you would like it to be changed. There are several reasons why the proposal is of absolutely critical importance when you're doing rating litigation. The first is that the proposal, there's a whole series of cases which say that the proposal dictates the tribunal's jurisdiction. The tribunal's, and indeed the court's, jurisdiction in rating is fixed by the dispute raised in the proposal. So if, for instance, you say in your proposal that the rateable value of a property is wrong, then the tribunal cannot change the hereditament, even if it wants to, because the proposal says rateable value is the issue. That's all it can do. So sculpting your proposal in the right way is absolutely essential to furthering your client's interests. Sometimes you can find yourself in a position where you have to make multiple proposals to cover off everything that you need to deal with. The second important aspect of the proposal is that the exact way that things are put in the proposal will determine what the material day is going to be, the day on which you look at the physical facts, as Dan explained. Sometimes, for instance, the alteration you're seeking can look very similar between two proposals, but because it arises in a slightly different way, one to the other, you can get a material day which is years and years apart. And, you know, if the circumstances cease to exist or changed in between those two dates, it can be the difference between success or failure. So the proposal is an essential document. A handful of other concepts relating to the way that rating arises, the way that rates are actually billed. Listening to what we've been talking about so far, you've heard about how the rateable value is a value year to year. It's based on an annual rental value. Billing for rating takes place annually. And the concept of occupation, whether you occupy for a long enough period, is determined by reference to years of time. The year is a unit of time. You'd be forgiven from all of that thinking that rates was an annual tax. However, since 1990, it's actually been a daily tax. Rating arises day to day. It's one of the peculiarities of the rating system that many of the concepts which are incorporated into the modern law.
Okay, so you've done all of that, have you? Round the numbers below to the nearest multiple of 100.
I think we've got someone who's taken themselves off mute.
To the nearest 100.
Can I ask, please, that if you're listening to this and you're not on mute, you can see the mute button down in the bottom left corner. If you can just click on that for us, that'd be really helpful. Brilliant, thank you. Daily rate, yeah. One of the peculiarities of rating is that concepts which existed when the tax was differently structured are incorporated into the modern law. So a lot of the concepts of rating arise from a time when it was an annual tax, even though now it's a daily tax. Most of the time that doesn't make a lot of difference, but where it can become relevant is in the context of disputes about the enforcement of the tax. Issues can arise in rating litigation about whether or not a person is under an existing liability for the rest of the year, for instance. And the answer is no, you're not. Anyone who occupies a building today has no liability for the building tomorrow. It's not until tomorrow comes that you become liable. And that can have quite a profound impact sometimes on the shape of litigation. The final thing to mention and the final concept before we move on is something which we call the multiplier, or the universal base rate, the UBR. This is a concept which is important because the rateable value, the RV, isn't what you actually pay. The way that rating works since 1990 is that central government sets a percentage. It's normally between 0.4 and 0.5, or between 40 and 50%. And that percentage will be the amount of the rateable value that you actually have to pay over to your local authority in rates in any given year. Even that isn't quite the whole picture, because quite often the real driver behind rating litigation is something called transitional relief, which is our final concept. The idea of transitional relief is that when you change from one rating list to the next, because you're updating the economic considerations from those in 2008 for the 2010 list to 2015 for the 2017 list, you've got 7 years worth of difference there. What that can do is it can cause real dramatic changes in the rateable value for a given property. Yeah, you could have a very high rateable value in one list, which then suddenly drops in the next. Or much worse for ratepayers, you've got a rateable value which leaps from one list to the next. The effect of transitional relief is that it smooths the transition from one to the next, so that over several years, you gradually find the amount you pay go up from what it would be without transitional relief to what it would be anyway. You get this sort of phased shift up or down. So you don't get the full impact of a rise straight away. Conversely, you don't get the full benefit of a fall in rateable value straight away. As I say, quite often, if you dig into the commercial decisions which underlie rating litigation, you often find that it's transitional relief, which is the thing which makes the real financial difference to the person who has to pay. That's then going to take us on to our third topic, which is where to look for the law on all of this. I'm going to pass you back to Dan, who's going to talk to us about the central statutory regime and the satellite secondary legislation. Dan.
Thanks, Steve. And I'll try and do this by way of a very brief overview. So obviously rating is a statutory tax, so one needs to look at the main taxation statute, which is the Local Government Finance Act of 1988. And the non-domestic rates part of that is primarily in Part 3 of that Act. So that's the critical starting point for all the statutory provisions. Many of them are enabling provisions that take you off to other regulations or to schedules of the Act. But within Part 3, you've got Sections 41 and 42, which are for the provision and compilation of rating lists. And that's where the Valuation Officer's duty to maintain an accurate rating list is to be found. Section 43, which is the foundation for liability for occupied rates, and that's parasitic upon the occupation of a hereditament, a prescribed hereditament shown in the relevant rating list. Section 45, which is the basis for the imposition of unoccupied rates, and again, it has to be a prescribed hereditament, and the owner is occupied, is liable, as Luke has already explained. Very briefly mentioned Section 46A, which is about something called completion notices, which is a mechanism for putting a new building into the rating list on a deemed basis to deem it to be a hereditament, for basically deeming it to be complete, and complete is ready for occupation for the purposes for which it has been constructed. So that's an important practical provision that there's been quite a lot of litigation about. Then Section 52 sets up the central list that we've talked about. Section 55 is very important because it enables the statutory instruments that deal with alterations and proposals and changes to the rating list. I think one really key thought I want to get across is that there's a high level of formality in rating. So the state of the rating list on any given day is absolutely critical. And for the purpose of enforcement that we're going to come on to, it's assumed that you can't challenge it. So the way of changing it is primarily through making proposals. And there are special rules about what the grounds for proposals are and the time limits and nature of effectiveness and whether it can be backdated, and if so, how much, all of which are in the really important regulations made pursuant to Section 55 of the 1988 Act. And then finally, between Sections 64 and 67, there's a series of interpretation provisions, and that includes what is a hereditament, which sends you back off to the 1967 Act, which also then sends you off into an inquiry into how things always were, which is how lots of the common law comes into rating. So not very user-friendly statutory definitions, but that's how they fit together in that overarching statutory scheme. So the next one is one I've already mentioned, Schedule 6. That's the Bible for how you value. That's where the statutory hypothesis for fixing the rateable value is contained. Schedule 6 of the 1988 Act. Now, the collection and enforcement regulations of 1989 govern all the provisions for billing authorities to bill for, demand, collect, and enforce the rates, but they can only do so in accordance with the rating list. So they can't enforce rates other than in accordance with what's in the rating list. And they also have a duty to demand rates promptly. And if they're in breach of that duty, there might be the ability to prevent them from recovering, subject to questions of whether there's prejudice or not arising from that breach of statutory duty. But in order to understand anything about the collection and enforcement of rates and local authority powers, you go to the 1989 Collection and Enforcement Regulations. We've talked a lot about unoccupied property. So the 2008 Unoccupied Property Regulations are critical in determining what is and isn't a prescribed hereditament. And this is where a whole series of reliefs are to be found. And I say reliefs, but that's a slightly inaccurate shorthand. It's effectively circumstances in which property is not a prescribed hereditament, and so liability does not attach to it. And those are very, very important, including the ability to have short periods of occupation that reset a six-month period of exemption for certain types of property, or 3 months in the case of offices. So those are of immense practical significance in advising clients. And finally, one of Luke and my favourites, quite important in practice, but sounds really something for rating anoraks, the Plant and Machinery Regulations. And they tell you what it is that you are valuing as part of the hereditament. And the basic scheme is that if it's plant and machinery, it's only to be valued as part of the hereditament if it's within one of the prescribed classes within the Plant and Machinery Regulations. Those are complicated, but really important and often of enormous practical significance to clients. So those are the statutory sources. Luke's going to say briefly a few things about some other sources of law.
Thanks very much, Dan. As Dan's mentioned, one of the peculiarities of the 1988 Act is that it refers to things by reference to the law before it existed. So it tells you that the hereditament means what the hereditament was had the Act not been passed. The same's true for occupation. It tells you that occupation means what it meant before the Act was passed. And that gives case law an unusually prominent role in rating compared to other taxes. You simply cannot understand how rating law works or what the answer to any given question is going to be without going back to the way that the judges have dealt with it in the past. And this can be an exercise which involves going back a really long way. Dan and I, about 3 weeks ago, were in the Supreme Court arguing about whether cash machines are, the sites of cash machines are hereditaments or not. And a lot of the discussion revolved around a very old case from the 19th century as the starting point, when the notion of a cash machine would have been deep in the realms of science fiction. So even for cases turning on very modern types of occupation, we've got to look sometimes at very old cases. The court which these days is most concerned with rating is the Upper Tribunal. And of course, its substantive decisions are of great significance in making the body of case law. Its decisions are also relevant in terms of the practice and the procedure of rating. And this is particularly important for the surveyors out there listening, which I hope there are some. The Upper Tribunal, certainly in the last 18 months, has become very, very interested in what surveyors should be doing as a matter of professional practice when they are acting or advising or appearing as experts in rating cases. So if you're a surveyor or solicitor advising a surveyor and you want to understand what your duties are, you've got to look at what the Upper Tribunal's had to say about how you ought to be behaving. Two final points to mention on this, two final sources. They're not strictly sources of law, but they approach it on occasion in their authority. The first is a document called the Rating Manual. It's maintained by the government agencies responsible for rating, the Valuation Office, which is part of HMRC. And the Rating Manual sets out guidance to the employees of those agencies about how the rating system should work. And it's often a helpful starting point if you want to understand how a particular area works to have a look at the Rating Manual. It's all available online, very easy to find the relevant bit through Google. It's not, though, a source of law as such, and the tribunals and courts can and do say that the contents of the Rating Manual aren't right on occasion. Finally, there are two very authoritative practitioner texts which need mentioning. The first is called Ride on Rating. It's been around since the mid-19th century. And as recently as last week, the High Court was endorsing and quoting paragraphs of Ride as being what the law should be for rating. The second is called the Encyclopedia of Rating, which carries out much the same type of function as RIDE. It analyses the different sections of the statute, the different valuation methods and so on. And it's a really, really useful guide to what's where. Final section we're going to talk about now is who's who. I'm going to pass you back to Dan to start that off. But before I do so, certainly I should mention very briefly. So we're going to try to leave a couple of minutes at the end for questions. The way we're going to do this is if you've got a burning question that you want dealing with, there's a chat function in here on Zoom. If you just put your question in the chat as a question to us all, if there's time at the end, me and Dan will have a quick skim through and try to answer a couple of those for you. Back to Dan to start talking to us about who the key players are. Dan.
Thanks, Luke. So we've covered quite a lot of this section, but the reason we wanted to just draw this together is we think that actually when you come to rating, sometimes it's not entirely clear what the divisions of responsibility are, and it's really very important to have that clearly anchored in your mind. So the valuation office agency or the valuation officer, their responsibilities are the compilation and maintenance of accurate rating lists. So primarily what they're interested in is whether property should be shown in the rating list, how it should be shown, and how it is to be valued. And they make those decisions, and then they're challenged through the making of a proposal to alter the rating list that then can turn into an appeal to the tribunals that we're going to mention in just a while. So they're concerned with compiling and maintaining accurate rating lists. They are, in the traditional view, entirely neutral as to, if you like, the collection, enforcement, or quantum of rates. Traditionally, they are just there to fix the right hereditaments and have the right values attached to them, and that's their function. Obviously, the way they exercise their function has huge commercial significance for ratepayers, but they ought traditionally to be entirely neutral as to those and only interested in getting it right and getting the correct rateable value. Different role, entirely different role, is the billing authority. The billing authority has to take the list as they find it. If they don't like it, if they think it's wrong, they can't change it themselves. They can pass on information to the valuation officer. They can agitate for the valuation officer to change the rating list. They might even, in limited circumstances, be able to make proposals to change that, although those powers have been quite severely curtailed. But they are concerned with actually making sure that people pay. So they're the people that demand the rates, that they chase down ratepayers who don't pay, and they take them to the magistrates' court or exceptionally the High Court in order to do that. But if you've got a dispute about who's in rateable occupation of the property shown in the rating list, then that is something that might be played out in the magistrates' court or an enforcement situation, or also if the level of rates, there's not a dispute about the rateable value, but there's a dispute about whether you're entitled to, for example, mandatory charitable relief, then that's a dispute that might take place against the billing authority rather than a valuation officer. So the critical thing to get into your head is if it's to do with the nature and accuracy of the rating list itself, then that's an issue with which the valuation officer is concerned. If it's to do with collecting, enforcing, or entitlement to a relief, which governs how much has to be paid, then that's something with which the billing authority is concerned. Standing over all of this, but not terribly vigilantly, is the Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government, and arguably also the wider policy section of the HMRC. And they have got the ability within the statutory scheme to make exemptions. So, for example, highly topical, there's a series of rating exemptions that have been announced to help certain businesses deal with the COVID-19 situation. Obviously, there's also a large amount of help for small businesses that's enacted through these reliefs. But their policy interventions tend to be quite piecemeal, quite reactionary to whatever's in the newspaper or whatever the big head of steam is. And there's other parts where actually the machinery of the day-to-day rating infrastructure would allow them to intervene, take roles, deem things to be hereditaments or make special arrangements to prevent, for example, rates mitigation, but where they are quite inactive in practice or have been so far. But I think it's important to know that they have the overall responsibility for the rating legislation. That's not the job of the valuation officer. The valuation officer has to just compile the list in accordance with the legislation. They're not the people that are responsible for what that legislation says. So those are those three key players. Luke's going to just mention the tribunals and courts very briefly before we take questions. Luke.
Thanks, Dan. Tribunals and courts. All you need to know, in effect, is that there are two tracks through the court system in this context. If what you want to challenge is something the valuation officer has done, something in the list, then the first instance court, which you have to go to, is called the Valuation Tribunal for England. It hears cases normally in panels of two, and sometimes the president and vice presidents are legally qualified or qualified surveyors. More often than not, the members are lay volunteers like magistrates. From the Valuation Tribunal, there is an absolute right to appeal. You don't need permission. You can always appeal to the upper tribunal, where your case will be heard by either a lawyer, judge, or by a chartered surveyor member, or sometimes by both. And it's not an appeal in the conventional sense. The upper tribunal conducts a rehearing, so it can make fresh findings of fact, for instance. It's not bound by anything decided by the valuation tribunal. Conversely, the second track, if you want to challenge something done by the billing authority, a decision about the application of a relief or who's in occupation or so on, is usually through the magistrates' court. And the normal way that ratepayers get disputes determined in the magistrates' court is simply not to pay the rates, at which point the billing authority serves a series of demands culminating in a summons to the magistrates' court. And you can then go along to the magistrates' court as a ratepayer defendant and argue your case about why you shouldn't have to pay the amount of rates that's been demanded. From there, there's an option to appeal onwards to the High Court, but only on a point of law. Right, that is a very quick, quite broad, we hope, run through some of the key concepts and give you a sense of what this subject area is all about. We've got four more sessions coming up that are going to dig into some of those areas in a little bit more detail. I'm going to pop the front page off of share now so I can have a look and see if we've got any questions come in. And we do have a couple, I think. Dan, do you want to...
Have we got any? I can see that Richard has very helpfully posted the details of tomorrow's event for people and the link, which we'll also put on LinkedIn and on the website. But I actually can't see any specific questions. There's a question about whether we've got a copy of what we've spoken about. I think there's probably going to be the ability to do a bit of a sort of speaking outline of the terms that we've covered, and it may be that we can also put this it may be that we're going to put these on our website so people can access and watch them again, so we'll take that one away and do what we can with that one. So what reference point would the valuate, there's a question just come in, what reference would the valuation officer use to determine if property is ready for being valued? So that's a question about completion notices that you'll recall. I mentioned the statutory basis is section 46A and schedule 4A of the 1988 Act. And the test is whether it's capable of beneficial occupation. And basically there's a couple of cases on that. One to do with offices, the upper tribunal in a case called Porter, and one to do with warehouses, that's the upper tribunal in a case called Aviva. And in both of those, they looked at the nature of the property and they asked whether it was ready for occupation. And in both instances, they indicated that if it was nearly ready, but it wasn't actually ready, then the completion notice procedure of deeming it to be complete and giving notice and having a potential appeal about whether it was ready or how long it would take to get it ready needed to be acted upon. So I think the key takeaway, I would say, is it's to do with the nature of the property, but a great many modern properties today are designed in ways that are intended for things to be done to them before they are actually occupied, which become part of the property to be valued, and therefore billing authorities acting prudently will in a great many cases need to serve completion notices if they want to get these properties into the rating list in order for them to be valued prior to their occupation. If they are in fact occupied, then it would be very hard to make the argument that they're not capable of beneficial occupation. That argument tends to fall away, but it's a real issue for unoccupied rates for a speculatively built property of the type that we often see in an office or even a warehouse context. Luke, do you want to take another question?
Yes, of course. Thanks very much. We've just had a question come in about the magistrates' courts and about how you can defend a liability order. And this is quite an interesting point. There's some strange case law on how the magistrates' court work in the liability order context. So, for instance, there are these strange swinging burdens that go on. Sometimes the billing authority has the burden of proof on some issues. Other times the ratepayer has the burden of proof on other issues. The simple way to test whether or not you can raise a point in a liability order proceeding or not is this. Is the issue that you want to challenge something to do with what's said in the rating list or not? If the answer is yes, you can't challenge it in a liability order proceeding. If the answer is no, you can, usually. So if you think your rates are too high, you're paying too much rates because you think your property's RV is too high, that's not something the magistrates can do anything about. They have to take the rating list as they find it. But if you think you're paying too much rates because you're a charity and you should get mandatory relief, then that is something which you can raise in the magistrates' courts. And indeed, it's the usual way of raising that kind of an issue. So the magistrates' court isn't limited to the whether or not the council's followed the formalities, although you can argue about those. It covers, in effect, anything relevant to billing which doesn't come from something or other in the rating list. So that's, I think, covers that one. Dan, is there anything you want to add or on any others?
No, that's fine. No, thank you very much. That's very comprehensive. I'm looking at the questions and there's some really great questions, but I think probably we're going to have to put something of a guillotine because we've sort of rather overshot the time that we've indicated and there will be some other sessions. So I think what we'll do is, We probably won't discuss any of these questions now, but we will review them and we'll see whether there's ways in which they can be dealt with in some of the coming sessions or otherwise if there's another way that we can try and pick them up and help. So I think I'm going to draw proceedings to a close for today. I'd like to thank everybody very much indeed for joining us. I hope it's been useful. I appreciate we've tried to cover quite a lot of ground. We've tried to do it in a reasonably accessible way, but we will see whether or not we can actually put a link to this or that we can give a more detailed outline of the matters that we covered and find a way of distributing that to people on request. We welcome any comments that people have. We've got an email, rating@landmarkchambers.co.uk. So please feel free to send any feedback to our rating email that we've created to sort of deal with the administration for this seminar. Please do tune in at 4 o'clock tomorrow. I'm going to be there, but I'm just going to be helping to facilitate it. And there's a real treat. We've got Tim Morshead QC, who represented the government in the ATM litigation, and who is a fantastic speaker, together with Alistair Mills, who's been in a recent important case on hereditaments. And they're going to cover two of the key concepts, rateable occupation and the hereditament, that are fundamental to what we've been talking about. in outline today and to an understanding of rating law. So I very much hope you found this assessment some use. Please feel free to drop in to all or any of the other sessions and to encourage any of your colleagues to do that. We hope this has been of use and that this might be the start or continuation of your interest in rating law. So thank you very much indeed for joining us. And I hope that many of you will be able to join Landmark Chambers Rating Seminar at 4 o'clock tomorrow, when Tim Morshead and Alistair will be dealing with rateable occupation and the hereditament. But we'll say goodbye. Please stay safe and take care, and we'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone. Thanks.
To stay on the line, Nick.
Yeah. So, Richard, do you want to end the meeting? I don't think I've got the...
Yeah, stay there.
Thanks.